Palestinian people have been living under occupation for a long time, and despite hardships, people still need to put food on the table. This has resulted in a lot of savvy entrepreneurs with resilient, adaptive business models. This was a quote given to the New York Times by our guest today, Syed Nashef, joining us all the way from East Jerusalem. Joining us in today's episode, we have Syed Nashef, Managing Director of Sadara Ventures and Kauffman Fellow from Class 14. You will love his inspiring story of growing up in East Jerusalem, to moving to the U.S., to ultimately moving back to Palestine to start a venture capital fund focused on Palestinian entrepreneurs. Listen for the two-word phrase that he learned at Microsoft and now uses with the entrepreneurs he works with every day. I'm so pumped for this episode. Let's do it.
You're now in the arena.
All right, welcome back to the Arena Podcast. We are pumped today to have Syed Nashef with us, the founding partner at Sadara Ventures. Let me tell you a little bit about Syed. So Sadara Ventures, which he started and co-founded, is the first early stage venture capital firm in Palestine, investing in internet, mobile, and software startups. His career has transcended being an operator, an engineer, and working in policy. As an entrepreneur, Syed founded and was a managing director of Equium in MENA, which was acquired by iConnectTech, a company based in Ramallah, Palestine. Prior to that, he co-founded and was CTO of Equium. In June of 2010, he served as a member of the U.S. presidential delegation to the Palestine Investment Conference in Bethlehem. He was also a Palestinian delegate to the U.S. Presidential Summit on Entrepreneurship. And Syed started his career at Microsoft, and Syed is a Kauffman Fellow. You know, Syed, as we get going, I love this quote, and I want to start with this quote, and then I'll welcome you to say hi. But this is a really cool quote from Syed about the opportunity in Palestine. I do believe that the work being done here for people who have a connection to the region will always feel more meaningful. It doesn't matter how successful I was or could have been in the States. It wouldn't have meant the same as the work I do right now. Truly, truly inspiring. So please welcome Syed Nashef.
Great to be here, Jeff. I'm really excited about doing this and about having the opportunity to talk to you and, you know, hopefully share some of my story with your listeners.
Awesome. Well, we're pumped to have you as well. Syed, what for the listeners, what Kauffman class were you in?
I was in Kauffman class 14.
That was the best class. Is that right?
I mean, I don't think that the awesomeness factor in any of the classes at the Kauffman Fellows is going to be especially unique in class 14. But for me, you know, that group of people was definitely, you know, a unique group of people.
Yeah, you had an awesome class. So let's talk about, I'd love to get just a little bit of the background and the formative experiences in your life, Syed. So we're, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm looking at you, I'm seeing Jerusalem in the background already. That's just such a cool thing to be doing. Tell us a little bit about you, where you're born, kind of the formative experiences of you know, kind of what made you you.
Sure. I mean, I'll start with sort of the background and where I was born. I was born actually here in East Jerusalem, not very far from where I'm sitting right now, about like 5 minutes actually from right now. My parents are both Palestinians. They're both originally from a village in the north called Taibe. And, you know, 1 year after I finished high school, I basically left the country and headed out to the States. I went to school I went to high school in a basically an Anglican school, which belonged to a church. You know, it might seem a little bit odd because, you know, I'm personally a Palestinian Muslim. Although there are obviously many Palestinian Christians, I went to a school that's actually run by a church, and the majority of the students in the school also were Muslims, and it just sort of reflects for you the sort of the makeup of the population here in Palestine. You know, we have a Christian minority and a Muslim majority. But the great thing, or sort of one of the early experiences, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, is something that you will you sort of get a sense of when you interact with sort of Palestinian community on the ground. One of the great things that I experienced very early on is, you know, we had we went to school with people of diverse religions, of different religions, of sometimes diverse backgrounds, and sometimes even different diverse colors. You know, we have people of you know, African descent here in Palestine. We went all to the same school, and we had you know, very strong relations. The only thing that was funny at school is that when you know, we had the class for religion, you know, the Muslims and the Christians would go into different classes, and you know, and each will have their own instructions. I would have rather, you know, had one class for, you know, on Christian theology and another class on Muslim theology, but you know, that didn't happen. But
that wasn't it.
No, that wasn't it. But that was a very interesting experience in the sense that from the very early days, sort of religion and color and background didn't really come into the equation. It was almost it was transparent. It wasn't something that we thought about or came up in the equation as far as sort of the Palestinian community that I was part of here.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because if you ask anybody else around the world, tell us what you think about Jerusalem, they all have very different narratives in their own mind based on what they think about that particular area in the world. For you growing up as a youth and going into high school, tell us, what was that like for you? Did you see, I mean, you kind of just said it, but maybe dive into that a little bit more. Was there a feeling of it's them and us? Did it feel like everybody was the same? You know, you were around Israelis and Palestinians and all sorts of diverse. Tell us just a little bit about that, how you viewed your upbringing and growing up.
So remember, I was growing up basically in you know, basically in the 80s, you know, early to late 80s, and in the political situation back then in Jerusalem was much more, I would say, or much less stable than it is today. And in the years of basically, you know, 1969, which is when I was born, now I'm telling my age all of a sudden.
Right. It's all right, man. Keep going.
So 1969, you know, all the way through sort of my, when I left in the late 80s, there was a lot of turbulence. It was basically turbulent times, actually, in East Jerusalem for the most part. So growing up in that time, I still remember, honestly, you know, in my early childhood, you know, at least a couple of nights where sirens were going off. We're talking about very, you know, early 70s, where sirens were going off, and you know, there were airplanes overhead and whatever. But it was sort of growing up in an environment that you could say at least it's unstable, but it was actually more than that. You did feel that you were sort of, you know, subject to a force that is a foreign force, basically. It's hard to describe if you've never experienced this as a child sort of growing up. But one of the things that, you know, that's enough to say is that you don't take things for granted that, you know, a normal kid's growing up somewhere in the US would also take for granted.
Sure. Sure. Thank you for sharing that. And so now you graduate high school, you go over to the U.S. What's that like, going to the U.S., maybe for the first time, going to school there? Tell us a little bit about that experience.
I left to the States in 1988. That was about a couple of years after I graduated. And I honestly, like, when I left, it I mean, I told everybody that I was going to the States to go to school. But I think internally between me and myself, I think the core reason for me leaving is that I just felt that I can no longer, tolerate being here, really. And it wasn't tolerate in the sense of, you know, not being able to, you know, live normally, whatever normal is. But, you know, I felt that there was always some ceiling, or the ceiling for what I can do or what I accomplish being here is pretty low. But I think the one thing that sort of stayed with me from the time of going to school in the States was the fact that you basically went to school with this mentality of exploring. It wasn't that, you know, there is a preset path, a predetermined path that you just need to go out and follow. It was more of a, you know, yeah, maybe you have an idea if you want to study this or that or the other thing, but you know what? You could just start and do some general ed classes and explore this and explore that. And then as you learn more and get more experience, then you can maybe come up with some choice that is more, you know, is more fit or more acceptable or more agreeable to you. And that is something that to me was a revelation. It wasn't something that I originally thought or felt that, hey, you know, you could have this much choice and flexibility in life, even when it comes to, you know, figuring out what do you want to study and what you're really interested about in and passionate about.
That's awesome. But what a great revelation for you to come to. So how long were you in the States before you decided to move back to Palestine or to East Jerusalem?
Almost a little over 19 years. I spent a little over 19 years. Yeah, a lifetime.
Okay, so it was exactly the same amount of time as you were not in the States. So you spent half your life in East Jerusalem and half in the States. And so you get to this point where you come to the States with all these intense feelings of emotion, wanting to explore and kind of escape what was the reality of your life to that point. And then you come up with these new revelations and maybe some enlightenment. What was the, tell us about the thought process that says, okay, it's time for me to move back to my home city, my home country. What was the driver in making you move back?
I think some of the things that sort of led to me deciding to come back had to do with the experience in the U.S. I think, as you mentioned earlier in your introduction, I spent a good part of my career back then at Microsoft, and one of the experiences that sort of I went through at Microsoft was this, I think, professional but also personal growth of realizing that, just very simply, you know, I guess two words, I can. And having gone through that and then sort of left Microsoft and got into sort of the startup world, I got to a point where I realized that in addition to sort of the I can, right, every time sort of I accomplished something which seemingly before felt like, you know, very hard or impossible or hard to achieve, you get to a point where you sort of start thinking, okay, now what, right? So I'm done, right? Like I did that. But what's next? And what that sort of, I guess, taught me is that I've for the longest period of my life, I always thought that, you know, if I get to this, if I'm able to accomplish that, if I'm able to sort of get to this level of whatever financial stability, job, you know, family situation, etc., then I'll be happy. And then it dawned on me, and I think this was sometime in, you know, early 2000s, it dawned on me that I'm chasing something that every time I get close to, it's going to sort of, you know, move forward and become farther. And that I have to do something where today I'm able to experience this happiness or this satisfaction or whatever, or self-fulfillment. It has to be happening every day. It cannot be something that I'm just sort of chasing after. And I think that was the time when I eventually realized that I want to go back home, maybe not permanently, but I want to go back home to feel that I'm doing something that that has a deeper meaning to me, and maybe also to my family and to my children. I really had no idea what I was going to do. I literally at one point just basically decided I'm going back. And I told my partners at Equiem at the time that I'm just going to take 1 year sabbatical, picked up and came. That was it. And I really had no idea. I had no plans of starting a business here. I had no plans of starting a venture capital, you know, none of that.
That's awesome. Gosh, thank you so much for sharing that. And so as you now transition into this world where you come back to Palestine, you stumble on this idea of venture capital. You'd already been a successful entrepreneur. The company had gotten acquired. Tell us about how you met, this structure of Sidara, and particularly your partner, Yadin. The story is so incredible. Tell us a little bit about how you met Yadin. Tell us a little bit about him and why Sidara for you.
So I met Yadin Kaufman, who's a seasoned venture capitalist in Israel. He's been in the venture capital industry for probably now over 25 years. I mean, he's been there since the very beginning of the venture capital industry in Israel. I met him in early 2008, and the funny thing it was, I met him through a Palestinian business acquaintance. He made the connection, and at the time, Yadin was thinking about actually starting a venture capital fund to invest in Palestinian companies. Yadin has been actually thinking about this for a while. He realized that there is value in what Israel has created in terms of the vibrant startup ecosystem, not only to Israelis but potentially also to the whole region. That has been happening already in other parts of the world in terms of companies taking their products to markets in the U.S., companies in Israel taking their products to markets in the U.S. But it hasn't so much happened or spilled over, whether at the level of the industry or the level of the market in the rest of the region. And so Yadin was basically thinking, well, what can we do to sort of take what Startup Nation has learned over the last 15, 20 years back then and apply it to other pockets of innovation in the region? And he decided that, you know, Palestine was, or investing in Palestinian companies was, a good place to start. Because obviously, if in a place or a region where you have instability, as the situation is in the rest of the Middle East, in many places in the Middle East, and including to some degree in Palestine, if you're able to sort of improve at least economic conditions, and then also in addition to that, create innovations that can sort of deal with the reality in that particular region, then you're going to, on the other hand, create stability that's good for Palestine, it's good for Israel, and it's good for everybody else. And so I met him in early 2008, and we spent some time, you know, getting to know each other. We discovered that we have great chemistry and decided to, you know, to go out and do this and start fundraising. For me, it was at that point, you know, doing something that has never been done before, to bring risk capital to Palestinian entrepreneurs. And I felt in some ways that it sort of tied back into some of the constraints that I've experienced when I was growing up, in the sense that, you know, if somebody at that time in East Jerusalem in sort of the mid to late 80s, you know, was dreaming of something, the possibilities of them being able to achieve that dream were very limited. And I think, you know, in a very small degree, maybe putting together this venture capital fund and providing entrepreneurs with the risk capital could enable, you know, help enable their dreams to become a reality and allow them to overcome the constraints that exist today in Palestine.
That's amazing. Now, when you think about fundraising, so many people that are raising their first funds, they go through all these hardships. They have to go through a lot of no's. I can't imagine. You hear, this is such an inspiring story where you have Yadin, who is an Israeli venture capitalist. You have you, who's been a Palestinian entrepreneur, going to raise this fund to invest in Palestinian startups. You must have gotten so many people looking at you going, are you nuts? Like, are you crazy? Tell me, were any particular stories that were difficult in the fundraising process? Maybe a short story about a rejection that you received, or and how you moved on from that.
So I think you're right. You know, like in you know, in terms of the story and the rejections, there were a bunch of rejections. I think the one particular thing I think that we've done early on that allowed us to be able to continue despite the rejections is that we realized, both Yadin and I, that the folks who are going to be interested in jumping on board with something like this are going to be folks who are, for one reason or another, interested in the region and interested in whether it is Palestine, Israel, or the rest of the Middle East. They're interested in having this region, you know, see a better tomorrow. And based on that realization, we sort of tried to really limit the universe of investors that we would go after and talk to, who could potentially sort of be aligned with something like this. The story that I really remember most was, you know, was not, you know, funny, you know, strangely enough, was not a rejection, but it ended up being a yes. It was with the European Investment Bank. The European Investment Bank was one of our anchor investors, and they were the first ones to, you know, sign a term sheet with us. But I do remember the first time that we went in their office in Luxembourg and met with, you know, three people of their team that were working on this, you know, on this fund. And you go through sort of the motions and the official questions and all of that. But one of the officers of the bank that was looking at our fund, her name is Paula. She could barely hide her excitement about what we're doing. I mean, she was always like throughout the interview or the question, she was, smiling with a big smile. Super friendly, so passionate, and you did feel at that point that the person sitting across the table from you is not trying to necessarily scrutinize you or to necessarily find holes in what you're doing. What they're really trying to do is ultimately partner up with you to figure out how can you make this a success. And to me, you know, this was the first time, I mean, I've never been a venture capitalist before. I've never sat down and talked to LPs before. But to me, it was, you know, it was our first, my first experience talking to LPs. And I was like, you know, damn, if all the LPs are going to be like this, great. I'm going to really have fun in fundraising. It wasn't like this for the rest, for all of the LPs. but I have to say that simply because we went after carefully selected set of LPs who cared about impact and who cared about the region, overall, the response was positive. Not everybody joined, but overall, the response was positive. So
inspiring. So there's this quote that I want to read from you. It says, in 2012, Sidara made its first deal, giving $1 million in Series A funding to the hotel booking startup Yam Safar. Since then, young Palestinians have come to view Ramallah as a serious option for setting up a company. Entrepreneurs and investors in the city hope this will stem the country's chronic brain drain of graduates to the U.S. and Europe. Now, I love what you said before, which was one of the things you learned at Microsoft was this notion of I can. And, you know, I've met Faris on one of my trips visiting Ramallah with you, and he's an exceptional talent, an exceptional person, and an exceptional entrepreneur. I believe he certainly has the idea of I can. Do you feel like Sidara has recognized or realized your hopes and dreams for it in helping Palestinian entrepreneurs kind of feel that same notion of I can?
That's a hard question. It's also a good question. I think, I think we've done a lot of good things in the investments that we've made so far. We've definitely backed some great entrepreneurs. Thaddeus is definitely our first and probably one of our most amazing ones. I have a great story to share about this, but maybe later. And we've created great jobs for a lot of talented Palestinians. Made it possible to show that for aspiring entrepreneurs that, yes, you can come up with great ideas, you can build great companies, attract capital, even attract international capital. After we set up shop, we're very happy to see folks like Ibtikar and, Amber, who's also a Kauffman Fellow, step into the game and start funding at the seed level. So over the last 10 years, there's been substantial progress. I'm not trying to obviously take credit for all of this, but I do believe that Sidara instigated in many ways and also accelerated what happened over the last 10 years in the Palestinian ecosystem. And for that, I'm tremendously grateful to and humbled by having the opportunity to play even a small part in all of this. Have we succeeded at what we want to do? I have to say that from my perspective, not yet. To me, I want to see the first Palestinian exit. I want to see the first end-to-end Palestinian success story. And until that happens, the ultimate goal of putting Palestine on the map as a real viable geography of producing and creating value to the region and to the world will not be realized. So I think we've made a great progress towards that goal, but we're not there yet. More work is needed.
Saad, I have one more question for you. So earlier in our conversation, you talked about growing up where you did and feeling the constraints and limitations based on the environment. Now, as you return and you're there, you spent so much of your life there, really the last 20 or so years. What advice would you give to a younger Saad or to entrepreneurs or other visionary, innovative individuals growing up there now that may be feeling those same constraints or limitations based on their environment? What advice would you give to them or to the younger side?
Look, I think, maybe two things come to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is that, what constraints we have in our reality ultimately have to do with have to do more with how we perceive them than their reality. And what I mean by that is that there are a lot of things that maybe a younger Saeed or even somebody today, living in Palestine, that can do and can overcome simply by looking at the constraints that exist around them, not necessarily as constraints, but potentially as challenges or as opportunities, and also really believing inside that they can be so much more than what their circumstances had made of them. I think knowing that in your soul is the most important thing, and it's the first thing, it's the first step. If you don't have that, you're not going to be able to really accomplish much. I think the second thing is surround yourself by great people, people who either can inspire you or can share their experience with you. I think ultimately I have many people who sort of over my life have been a major influence on me, and that journey and sort of the learnings that I got from them were things that you probably could live a lifetime and not necessarily experience, and it saved me from a lot of mistakes, failures, etc. Not that I don't have many of those, but it saved me from making more. And I think the last thing is be open to have an open mind to learning and learning as much as you can. And when I talk about learning, I don't talk about it in the limited sense of going to school or going to college. I went to school and but I never had a degree. So I do talk about it in the more general sense of the meaning in terms of learning, whether it is learning at work, learning from people, learning from your experience. So keeping an open mind about it. And the most important thing in learning, I think, is keeping humility. I honestly don't think that anybody is able to take real lessons and sort of, internalize them really and sort of apply them without having humility and knowing, that ultimately that we don't know or that what we know continues to always be very limited. So I think these are maybe the three things that I would share with folks out there.
Amazing, amazing and inspirational. All right, we've two rapid fire questions for you. In one sentence, if you had a genie in a bottle, what would be your one wish?
I think today my one wish from the genie in the bottle is to produce a Palestinian exit.
That's a good wish. And where can you find the best falafel?
That's an easy one. There is a restaurant right in the middle, a hole in the wall, basically, right in the middle of Ramallah. There is no place to sit. You stand, you order your falafel, and you pay for it and you go, and that's the best place.
I think you took me there. It's right off of that square, right? Right off of that roundabout?
That is the one, yes. You could have answered that question yourself.
Great falafels. Syed, you are an absolute inspiration. I'm so glad to know you. I'm so glad to have you share your journey and the things that you're working on with the Coffin Fellows and with us on this podcast. I know you as a incredibly humble individual who's got a wonderful family, and I can't wait to see you and them again. And thank you so much for joining us on our podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey listeners, thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Arena Podcast. As always, you can get notified of the latest release by subscribing to our newsletter found in the description of this episode or by visiting fellows.org. That's all for now. We'll catch you in the arena next week.